You know, it's my great pleasure right now to introduce to everybody a man who really needs no introduction.
Carl.
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 Carl. Dragon.
King.
Carl. I'm not calling the fans geeks. I'm not calling them rednecks, tobacco chewing nothing, because I've done all that myself.
Carl.
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 Carl. Dragon.
King. Carl.
In your dreams, you will see me.
Excuse me, please, let's don't talk negatively.
I'm going to win the title. I'm going to keep my money and buy me some good old Tennessee drinking whiskey with it.
Thank you for being such a great husband.
And this is for you, Fannie Mae. Solid gold, baby, just like you and me.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the latest in the When It Was Cool wrestling podcast series. I'm Carl Stern here. Thank you very much for listening. If you're listening to this at WrestlingObserver.com or Figure4Online.com, then this is the Dragon King Carl Classic Wrestling Audio Show. If you're listening to it elsewhere, it is the When It Was Cool Wrestling Show, and we do a rotation of shows about classic wrestling to keep things interesting and changed up a lot. And this is the sixth installment of our History of Pro Wrestling at Madison Square Garden series. We've been talking about the early history of wrestling at the most famous arena in the world, Madison Square Garden. When you think about legendary famous arenas, you certainly think about, you know, the Tokyo Dome in Tokyo, Japan. You think about Arena Mexico. You think about probably the Cow Palace in San Francisco and maybe the Olympic Auditorium in Los Angeles. You know, there are many, many legendary arenas. Whatever your favorite territory was, you've probably got a favorite one, Mid-South Coliseum in Memphis. But no doubt the most famous sports arena in the world is Madison Square Garden. And there have been multiple Madison Square Gardens, and we've been talking about that as well. In fact, we're up to the second Madison Square Garden now. We talked previously about Gilmore's Garden. And for those of you who may be new to this series and stuff, and maybe you're one of the modern era wrestling fans who isn't really sure when wrestling started being, quote, fake versus, or started being, you know, fake versus being real, or a work versus a shoot or whatever. And you may be under the misconception, as many people are, that it wasn't really until like the 1930s or 40s that pro wrestling became, you know, more worked than shoot. When in reality, from the very beginning, it's really been more theatrics than reality. Even back into the 1800s, which is where we're going to be talking about starting now, 1898 is where we'll be picking up back up today. And even back then, it was far more akin to the carnivals and vaudeville and performance art than it was an actual legitimate sport. Over the last several years, older and older clips of wrestling have come out, and I've put some of these up on at whenitwascool.com. If you go to the Ultimate History of Pro Wrestling Zone and go back to some of those early days, anytime I find a old film involving wrestling, I put it up on there. And they are so obviously cooperative. I'll say that much. They're so obviously cooperative, and they're clearly an exhibition for like a circus or carnival or some sort of entertainment show. The old like strongman shows and stuff would all oftentimes have other entertainment. Many would. Before the days of television, before the days of theater, you would go to the local opera house or playhouse and you know, see a you know, maybe a Shakespearean play or something like that being acted out, or there would be some sort of musical performance, like an orchestra, or there would be some sort of comedy show, some sort of, you know, skit acting combined with, you know, in between, they would put on some sort of performances, very much like the modern circus kind of is. And so that's the world where wrestling sprang from. And it's far more performance than reality. Now, were there real matches? Were there shoot matches? Absolutely. Were there real legitimate wrestlers, real tough guy wrestlers who were like, you know, you would consider today's mixed martial artists would be superior fighters to the average, you know, just untrained person on the street? Of course there were, very much so. But at best, my opinion, at best, that's half and half all the way back into the 1800s. Now, the last episode when we talked about this, if you want to go back and grab it from the archives, either at WrestlingObserver.com or over at WhenItWasCool.com. We talked about one of these early characters, and he was Ishmael the Terrible Turk Yusuf. And he was he was like, in modern terms, he was like a Goldberg or something, where he come along and was just very instantly a huge star. The newspapers made much to do about him. The promoters made much to do about him. His matches were largely hilarious works. He was put over as just the most incredible, like, very much like a Goldberg or the Road Warriors or Ultimate Warrior or something like that. Brock Lesnar even. He was put over as just the most superior wrestler in the world. Now, he came and did a tour and then was going to go back to Europe, and we don't really know what would have become next of the Ishmael the Terrible Turk phenomenon, because he died in a shipping disaster, a boating disaster, and you can hear all about that on last episode. But in the years following that, there were many Turk knockoffs. There were evil Turks. There were, you know, the great Turks. There were, you know, all sorts of imitation, terrible Turks, all the way up even really into the early 1980s, a good 100 years after the original terrible Turk Yusuf was killed. There were still great Turks in wrestling coming along. And so the name, there was just something about the name and the whole presentation that really struck with fans. So now we're going to pick up in November of 1898, and we're going to talk about for the first time one of the real legitimate tough guy wrestlers of any era, especially that era. He's going to be a future American heavyweight champion. He is going to be one of the people upon whom George Hackenschmidt is going to build his claim as the first true world heavyweight wrestling champion. And so just to jump just ahead a few years, George Hackenschmidt is going to be internationally, I guess in a lot of ways, what they were trying to build the Turk up for being, in that he was this unbeatable Russian wrestler. Okay, he's winning all these different tournaments over in Europe and Russia and England, and he's being crowned a different champion of this, champion of that. And ultimately, he's one of the pioneering strongmen. I mean, when you think about the pioneers of powerlifting and strongman and bodybuilding, you think, of course, of Eugene Sandow and also George Hackenschmidt. But George Hackenschmidt was also a very important early pro wrestler, pioneer, or just post-pioneer era pro wrestler, and rightfully so, because he really, the build-up for Hackenschmidt was tremendous all over the world. And so after conquering, you know, quote, as the papers would say, conquering Europe and conquering, you know, Asia or whatever, he never went as far as Japan, but I'm talking about, you know, like the Middle East and things like that, as the papers would refer to it at the time, he comes over to the United States, and there is an American champion, and that, at the time he comes over, is going to be Tom Jenkins. And so when he beats Tom Jenkins, he is the world champion. He has a rightful claim to, and now other people have been called the, quote, world champion before this. There were, you know, oftentimes wrestlers promoting themselves as world champion, you know, Greco-Roman wrestler, world champion, catch wrestler, or world champion, whatever. Wrestler, but as the world heavyweight champion pro wrestler, really catch as can, I guess, George Hackenschmidt is who we trace it all back to. And even your modern organizations, the NWA, National Wrestling Alliance, you know, tried to draw their lineage back to Gotch and Hackenschmidt, and of course your spinoffs like the AWA and WWF and all of those over the years have tried to draw their lineage back to that. So we're going to be talking about Tom Jenkins a lot going forward. And Tom Jenkins was the real deal. Many years ago, it's been probably 20 years or so now, when I was doing the Pioneers of Wrestling booklet and things like that, first getting, you know, stuff published for my research into the pioneer era of wrestling, I was actually contacted by one of the grandchildren of Tom Jenkins. It was, I think, his great-grandson. Who told me all about him. Of course, you know, Tom Jenkins, we know, went on to be the physical education and physical combat instructor at West Point Military Academy. So that's a pretty big deal. I think he was actually assigned by the President of the United States to that role. But he had told me a lot of things about the younger George Tom Jenkins that we didn't really know that much about. He lost his eye as a child in a fireworks accident. Actually, I think it's less a firework and more I think they were messing around with like a homemade cannon. And anyway, it exploded and he lost an eye. And he goes, he ends up becoming a steel mill worker. And how he gets into wrestling is they were doing a charity event for the steel mill. And, you know, this has some modern equivalents also. Somebody didn't show up or somebody got injured and they goaded young Tom Jenkins into going in there and wrestling. And he wins and he's quite a natural at it. Well, here he is for the first time at Madison Square Garden, November 5th, 1898. And again, I'll be relying most heavily upon Wrestling in the Garden, Volume 1, 1875 through 1939, which is one of Scott Teal's books and a really great resource. Do check it out, and you can order a copy if you'll go to whenitwascool.com, click on our Amazon link, and order a copy through there. That helps out our website. So November 5th, 1898, the attendance of 3,000 people. We even know the gate for this. The gate is $4,500. We have a world title match. Yes. Now, it's going to be a few years before, George Hackenschmidt is actually the, quote, real world heavyweight champion. But we're calling this a world lightweight title. Tom Jenkins, the champion, goes to a draw with Holly Adali. They end up splitting one fall apiece. And if you recall back when Ernest Robert met Ishmael the Terrible Turk Yusuf, there was quite a controversy about it. They fell off the ring. Okay, this is before the days of the standardized ring where you had to raise platform and the ropes and the turnbuckles and all that. No, they were just wrestling on a raised platform. And so I think it was the Turk pushed Robert off very quickly, and they called foul about it. And so there was much argument about, you know, who really won the match and what it was and all this stuff. So this time, to avoid such problems, they placed a wrestling mat actually on the arena floor. So this wasn't in a ring. This was just on a mat that had been like a standard wrestling match like you would see in college, collegiate wrestling matches. So Tom Jenkins goes to a draw with Holly Adali. Your other matches on the show were Fred Duncan beat Al Williams. I don't know much about either one of those people. Fred Duncan, I think I've seen his name listed a few times. That was a catch-as-catch-can match, and Jack Reed beat Joe Carl in your undercard. Now, the newspapers had this to say. Jenkins-Adali contest for honors at Madison Square Garden, and this is from, this pretty lengthy article here, is from the New York Times. Okay, so the New York Times covered this match. They said about 3,000 people went to Madison Square Garden last night to see a wrestling match between Holly Adali, the Sultan's Lion, and successor to the Terrible Turk. So see, here's your first Dollar General generic version of the Terrible Turk. It is the Sultan's Lion, Holly Adali. His opponent, Tom Jenkins, champion of America. So I guess Jenkins is the American champion at this point in time, which is kind of the earliest really well-known, kind of universally recognized heavyweight championship in the United States. Instead of seeing a wrestling match, however, they witnessed sprinting races. The Turk tried to get a hold of Jenkins, but Jenkins would run away from him all the time. The crowd jeered and hooted, called Jenkins a coward, and said all he seemed to think about was keeping out of the Turk's way. Jenkins won the first bout on a technical foul. Holly Adali then began chasing him all around the garden and finally, getting disgusted, strolled over to one of the attendant's chairs, picked up the towel, and mopped his head. Jenkins' friends at once made a rush to Tom O'Rourke, the referee, claimed a foul on the ground that, according to the rules, neither contestant may be handled by any man, refreshing himself in any way, or use a towel after a bout has commenced, until there has been a fall. O'Rourke gave the decision against the Turk. So we have a non-clean finish in one of the falls here, believe it or not. In the second bout, after chasing Jenkins around the garden for three quarters of an hour, the Turk managed to throw him by catching his wrist, and after arranging him carefully on the ground, he lay on top of him. 300-odd pounds proved too much for Mr. Jenkins, and after standing the pressure for about 12 minutes, he collapsed. The Turk was removed, Jenkins carried away by his attendants, and the fall awarded to the Turk, and the match declared a draw. Two other matches of stars of lesser magnitude were used as sort of a curtain raiser. So there's your early carnival term, curtain jerkers. Remember that? That's your opening match guys. Terminology still used, well, at least all the way up to the 1990s. I don't know if they still use curtain jerking or not, but your curtain raisers. The first of these was between Fred Duncan, who was billed as the champion lightweight of America, and Al Williams, the champion of Ohio. The winner of this match was to take the title of champion of the world in his class. So I guess that's what they were referring to as your world title match. Duncan won, throwing his opponent twice. The next bout was between Jack Reed and Joe Carl. The catch-as-catch-can rules, as the name signified, allowed a man to catch his opponent as he can. Reed won this, taking two falls out of three. Then came the star bout. The Turk was the first to appear in the arena, but Jenkins entered some minutes later. Both were well greeted. They were to wrestle catch-as-catch-can with the stranglehold and flying fall barred. I don't know what the flying fall is. It's interesting. It was some sort of flying head scissors or some sort of jumping press or something. I don't know. I don't know what that would be. I'm going to have to research that term a little more for this era. The stranglehold is grip around the throat. Oh, okay, they're going to explain it to us. Thank you, New York Times. And the flying fall barred meant that if one of the men were tripped and fell on his shoulders, it should not count as a fall. Okay, so it was nothing so elaborate as that. It's that if they tripped and fell of their own accord and landed with their shoulders to the mat, that was not a fall. The men had signed articles of agreement by which the winner of the purse was to get $1,000, the title of champion of the world, okay, another world title match, I guess, and 75% of the net profits. The loser was to take 25% of the net profits. They had agreed to wrestle on a mat in the middle of the arena, and throws were to be made only on this mat. Tom O'Rourke was selected as referee and Manny Friend as timekeeper. When Mr. O'Rourke called the time, the Turk jumped to the middle of the mat, touched an amulet that he wore around his neck, and knelt. Wow, this is shades of the Sheikh of Arabia, right? Shades of the Iron Sheikh and his Persian mat. Shades of, you know, the Japanese wrestlers and the salt throwing ceremony. Yes, 1898, folks. Some said he was offering a prayer for luck. The crowd roared with laughter, for he seemed to be salaming, I'm not sure the context of that word, to Captain Price, who stood in front of him with a big nightstick in his hand. The men shook hands. This, some thought, was done to show that there was no animosity between them and that they were simply wrestling for the shekels. Then each, with his head bent forward and his arms hanging loose, began to circle round and round on the mat. The Turk kept in the center and Jenkins kept to the edge. The Turk would then put his right hand on Jenkins' shoulder and watch for an opportunity to throw his left around the American's neck. But Jenkins was too fast. Then Jenkins tried to grab the Turk by the leg, but the big fellow got out of the way so easily that Jenkins seemed surprised. Jenkins was continually getting off the mat, but the Turk would motion to him to come to the middle. They kept this business up for about half an hour, Jenkins' idea seeming to be to tire his opponent out or to make him lose his temper. Once in a while, they would get together with their heads touching and circle round and round like two chickens preparing for a scrap. The crowd got impatient, began to hoot and jeer, and then the Turk called one of his friends over and consulted with him. He had an idea that he could not catch his opponent off the mat, but when he was told he changed his tactics. And the next time Jenkins jumped off the mat, the Turk was after him, and they sprinted all over the floor of the big arena. The crowd roared, and the Turk got fairly wild when he found he could not get his hands on Jenkins. He would return to the mat and wait for his opponent to come up again. After this sort of fun had been kept up for 40 minutes, this match sounds terrible, the Turk picked up the towel and mopped his head and was then disqualified. The two men had 15 minutes rest, and during the interval, challenges were read from each man who wanted to wrestle the winner. One was from Isidor, the Russian, clad in a Cossack uniform. The second bout began at 10:45 o'clock, and Jenkins repeated his sprinting tactics. After about 20 minutes of this sort of fun, the Turk walked to the middle of the mat, planted himself on his feet and hands, and allowed Jenkins to get a grip about him. Jenkins put his arm around the Turk's waist and squeezed, and when the Turk thought he had had enough of this squeezing, he took hold of Jenkins' arm, broke the hold, and transferred Jenkins to the place he had been occupying. Jenkins, however, managed to get away from him, and in a few minutes, the sprinting operations were resumed. The crowd was getting very tired, and the Turk was getting very mad. It began to look as if the sprinting match would be kept up until midnight, when Captain Price was going to order the garden cleared, but just 20 minutes before that time, the Turk managed to catch Jenkins' arm and pulled him down to the mat. Like a flash, he was on top of him, with his arms around Jenkins' waist and his legs locked around his opponent. For a minute or two, he kept perfectly still, simply resting, and then gradually straightened himself out and laid his whole weight on Jenkins. Jenkins tried to throw him off, but failed. He struggled, but the struggle grew weaker and weaker, and after 12 minutes, he became exhausted, and the Turk was awarded the fall. Thus said the New York Times, Sunday, November 6, 1898. I mean, that sounds like nothing other than a work match, right? I mean, they're playing theatrics, they're playing cat and mouse, they're chasing around the whole arena floor. It's a lot of silliness and comedy, it sounds like, and stalling, and this went on forever. 1898, folks. All right, when we come back, we'll talk about March 21st, the year 1900. Yes, we're going to go up to the year 1900. We're leaving the 1800s for our next battle at Madison Square Garden. And so we'll be right back after this.
WhenItWasCool.com is your source for the best in retro pop culture. When It Was Cool features articles and podcasts on retro TV and movies, toys, action figures, pro wrestling, food, video games, and more. Hit the Patreon button to support us and get instant access to hundreds of premium podcasts and features. Family friendly and fun. WhenItWasCool.com.
Okay, so we exit the 1800s and now we're in the spring of 1900 when wrestling next comes to Madison Square Garden. And March 21st, 1900. And we have an attendance of 8,000 people. So in the couple of years since we've last seen wrestling at Madison Square Garden, we've increased our attendance from 3,000 to 8,000. So we've over doubled our attendance. So that's off to a good start, right? Wrestling seems more popular here. And we actually own this card. Really have no name that's that huge a name. Our Ernest Robert being one. We've talked about Ernest Robert quite a bit at Madison Square Garden, so he's kind of a star there to be sure, but I mean, he's not like the, you know, the biggest and greatest or anything like that. So let's see here. March 21st, 1900, attendance 8,000 people. The American Greco-Roman heavyweight title match. We have Beck Olson beats Ernest Robert. They split one fall each, and then Robert is unable to continue, and so the championship changes hands. Ernest Robert, the champion, loses the American Greco-Roman heavyweight title to Beck Olson. In a catch-as-catch-can match, George Bothner, a well-known wrestler at the time, beats Jack Ryan, another well-known wrestler of the time, two falls straight. And, that's a catch-as-catch-can match between Bothner and Jack Ryan. Then we have a collar and elbow match between William Johnston, as he beats Gus LaRose, two falls to none. The Brooklyn Daily Eagle reported, they called the attendance 12,000. So here's somewhere we've come to the conclusion that's more realistically 8,000, but the Brooklyn Daily Eagle says 12, so a huge crowd regardless. saw the best match that has ever been wrestled in New York in years. Olsen won by one of the cleverest tricks seen on the mat. It is called a Cumberland fall. He spun around twice, presenting his back to Robert, who, in trying to catch a hold, rushed into the Dane's arms, and he was thrown hard with the whole 286 pounds of the Dane, I'm talking about Beck Olsen, on top of him. Beck Olsen was a pretty big guy then. He was carried to his corner, and a police sergeant refused to commit to permit him to continue. And again, you got to remember a lot of these, why the police are so heavily involved in these matches is because, again, think back to how this all started with William Muldoon. This was part of the Police Athletic Association, the Police Athletic League that William Muldoon was over and part of. And by this point in time, I guess William Muldoon is probably, if he's not yet, he's probably involved with the New York State Athletic Commission, where he ultimately becomes president of. So, Robert was carried to his corner and there refused to allow to continue. The March 22nd edition of the Richmond, Virginia Dispatch said, quote, "This match differed from recent contests of this order in so much as it was to all interest and purpose on the level." So there we are in 1900. They're discerning which matches are legitimate and which aren't. 1900. So again, every single time we do this show, every single time I did one of the earlier, you know, long-form history of pro wrestling shows, we see that nobody really at all believes this stuff to be legitimate. Sometimes it can be legitimate, and sometimes, most times it's not. So even here, the newspaper says, as best as we can tell, this match seemed legitimate. In newspaper accounts both before and after the match, some sources called Robert the American Greco-Roman champion, while others referred to him as the world Greco-Roman champion. The most significant wrestling name missing from the Garden Rolls is that of Evan Lewis the Strangler. Yes. So where has the original Strangler Lewis been? Well, he hasn't been at Madison Square Garden, right? The following article goes a long way toward explaining why Garden fans never seen the original Strangler Lewis. It is important to remember that Ernest Robert, was William Muldoon's hand-picked successor, and William Muldoon himself never wanted much to do with the original Strangler Lewis either. And so this is Sports by Otto C. Floto. Last Wednesday night, a new world wrestling champion was produced by his defeat of Ernest Robert. Beck Olsen, the Big Dane, became the possessor of that title at Madison Square Garden in New York. It must be admitted that Robert is the best of the Greco-Roman wrestlers of today, although he is far below the standard of champions of just a few years ago. Boy, does that sound familiar? That is a always repeating story. The wrestlers of this generation are not as good as the wrestlers of the last. They were even saying this in 1900. The song remains the same. Otto C. Floto, what a great name, continues, "Where would he be classed with such men as Whistler, Lewis, Carkeek, and Muldoon?" That, of course, being Clarence Whistler, the original Strangler, Evan Lewis, Jack Carkeek, William Muldoon, so on, when the latter were in their prime. In Lewis's hands, for instance, Robert was a child every time they met. The writer remembers one time very distinctly in St. Louis that Lewis and myself had agreed to go to St. Louis and wrestle any man that the local promoters could find on a Sunday afternoon at the Sportsman's Park. As it happened, Al Spink, who had charge of the show, secured Ernest Robert. We arrived at St. Louis on Sunday at noon and were very anxious to get back to Chicago that night, as it was a foregone conclusion that Lewis could throw Robert as fast as he wanted to. And before the show began, I went to Evan Lewis and told him to allow Robert to remain on the mat with him as long as possible, as there was a big crowd present and it was my desire to give them a good show. Yes, they're working this match. Lewis agreed to do this, and it required 15 minutes, if I remember right, to throw Robert in the first fall. The management of the park then came to us and asked that the intermission be made as long as possible, as they had a bar attached to the grounds and wanted to do all the business they could. We also agreed to this. When time was called again, We had only half an hour to catch the train back to Chicago and wrestle Robert another fall. Lewis asked me to tell him when 10 minutes had expired and he would try to finish it. When the 10 minutes had expired, I motioned to Lewis, and the strangler slowly pushed the shoulders of the big German to the mat. The referee, who, by the way, was the instructor of the St. Louis Turnverstein, did not seem to think that it was a fall and refused to allow it. As train time was fast approaching, his refusal to allow the fall so enraged Evan Lewis that he grabbed hold of Robert and threw him clear over his head, making him strike the ground flat on his shoulders and knocking all the wind out of him. All this was accomplished in less than a minute, and it demonstrated just what a grand master Evan Lewis really was and how much he outclassed the wrestlers of today. His famous hold was the stranglehold, so-called. Many of my readers will perhaps believe that by the stranglehold, it just meant that he put his arm around an opponent's neck and choked him almost to death. Such, however, was not the case. He would put his arm either around an opponent's jaw or around his forehead and then began to squeeze. It had a similar effect on a man as getting knocked out in a gloved contest. In reality, it was no stranglehold at all in the strictest meaning of the term. So they're claiming Evan Lewis was like knocking people out by squeezing their jaw instead of like a carotid artery hold that we'd know for the modern sleeper. Like, it's very strange. I wasn't even aware of that, quite frankly. Although Robert holds the title of Greco-Roman champion, yet it would be a grand struggle to see a tournament between Jenkins of Cleveland, Dan McLeod of St. Paul, Farmer Burns of Iowa, and Robert for the title. The winner of such a tournament could surely be called the champion, and his pretensions would not be questioned. Although Olsen threw Robert in New York last Wednesday, it will be well to watch how a contest between Olsen and Jenkins of Cleveland would result. The writer wants to go on record right now as saying that the Cleveland man would make a showing against the Danish invader that would somewhat astonish him. But there the matter stands. While our other sports have progressed, in the wrestling line at least, we have deteriorated. Racehorses have cut their records down. Our fighters have proved to the world that they are at the top of the heap in that branch of sport. Our oarsmen have done the same, and our ball players can simply not be beat. But alas and alone, the wrestlers have not kept up with the procession. Where once this country stood at the very front and dared the world to measure strength with our wrestling champions, we now have to take second money to a lot of the Turks, Danes, and foreigners. What has become of all of our strong men, or has the grand old Roman sport passed to those stages where interest in it is lost and the present generation and the coming one do not care to encourage it? Where does the trouble lie? So that was printed in Denver Sunday Post, Sunday, March 25th, 1900. Yes, an old veteran complaining about the newcomers. Can you imagine such a thing? The Brooklyn Daily Eagle, Sunday, March 25th, 1900, said, "Can it be that wrestling, the most scientific of all forms of personal physical contest, save only boxing, is to enjoy a return to popular favor after years of inactivity? It looked that way when Youssef the Terrible Turk was here, but the fiascos that attended his matches with Robert killed the sport again, or at least tapped it on the head as soon as it was raised, sending it back for another period of destitute. It looks more like it now, for the contest at Madison Square Garden last week brought forth a support, financial, vocal, and otherwise, that almost equaled the scenes at the big prize fights. Not being restricted by law, as is boxing, and the bouts being open to women, and two weighty reasons why the sport should prosper. When the crowd knows a back hammerlock as well as it knows an uppercut, or a three-quarter Nelson as well as it can tell a cross counter, the patronage will be big. The fact that Robert suffered a broken rib shows that it is not child's play, while the collar and elbow and catch-as-catch-can preliminaries were pretty enough bouts to enthuse almost anyone." So, wrestling getting some good pats on the back, so to speak, from this era, from the papers. And that will bring us now up to, there was only apparently this one wrestling show in 1900. When we revisit this again, we'll be up in 1901, where there are a few wrestling shows, and we'll be talking both about Ernest Robert and Tom Jenkins again when we get to that show. So I hope you have enjoyed this, and I hope you have enjoyed it enough to want to hear some of the other things we do over at whenitwascool.com, where we have a back catalog of some almost 2,000 shows, many of them dealing with pro wrestling history, but also retro pop culture, that meaning TV, movies, sports, music, reading material, books, comics, whatever, toys. We talk about retro pop culture over at When It Was Cool, and I hope you will come check us out. We are making a heavy push for our Patreon this month. Hope you'll become a part of that, because in October, we will celebrate Halloween all month long. It's one of the things we do at When It Was Cool, so we'll be talking a lot of monster and horror movies and how that relates to different things, even wrestling. We've got some shows that where various monsters, Frankenstein, vampires, mummies, have at one point in time showed up in the wrestling world as well. So we'll go back and check all that out right now over at whenitwascool.com and hit any of those Patreon buttons to become a supporter. Subscribe to all of our free shows, our YouTube channel, however you consume your entertainment, your podcast, your videos, whatever. We have something there for you. Hope you'll bookmark it and become a regular at whenitwascool.com. So thank you very much for listening. I am Carl Stern. And when we next come around here on Wrestling Observer, we'll be talking about the long-form history of wrestling. But before that, I'll have a special over at When It Was Cool. We're up into 1983 now, and so the Wrestling Observer newsletter is coming out monthly in 1983. So only at whenitwascool.com we will go through the next issue of the Wrestling Observer newsletter and talk about everything that was in it. I believe we're going to be talking about the April 1983 issue of Wrestling Observer Newsletter. That will only be at When It Was Cool. And then when we come back here to Wrestling Observer, figure4online.com, we'll cover that month on the long-form history of pro wrestling. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for checking us out, and we'll see you here again soon with another show.
If you liked what you heard, go to whenitwascool.com.
This is the sound of the 80s. Everybody's looking for it, and we've got it.
And hit that Patreon button.
If you'll excuse me, I need to go buy a new Cyndi Lauper CD and have myself a little cry.